I have a buddy named Ray Briers, and he owns a company called The Pipe Yard Inc., INC.com. And if you have a project that needs carbon steel pipe, he stocks everything you need. New surplus, secondary, you name it, rat hole, mouse hole, conductor casing, pipe pile, sign pole, structural, road bores, dredging. If you're buying or selling, you got an abandoned pipeline, wherever, he'll buy it. ThePipeYardInc.com, 409-788-PIPE, 409-788-PIPE.
It's been far too long since Victor Davis Hanson has graced our airwaves, but he has been busy. I've seen him with Seb Gorka and a number of others. His mind and thoughts are in high demand, and it is with that pleasure that we begin our conversation. He is the author of the book, The Case for Trump, a prolific writer, thinker, speaker. Victor, I want to begin. You tweeted the words that also begin a piece that you wrote, Crazy 2020 is Dead, Long Live Crazier 2021. I want to read them, and then I want to dive into them. You say, the proper conservative response to last Wednesday's violent entry into the Capitol and vandalism, as well as assaults on law enforcement, is to identify the guilty parties and ensure they are arrested. Such deterrence will prevent any future devolution from legal popular protests into thuggery. No constitutional republic can tolerate its iconic heart stormed, breached, and defiled. And as I said, you tweeted that as well. Obviously, that's an important sentiment for you. But I want to explore that, if I could. Surely there is some place short of what happened on January 6th that would be acceptable in a nation of protest. What is that line? What was the line to which they could have walked but not transcended?
Well, they could have done what 99% of them did. Everybody has a right to demonstrate peacefully. So when Donald Trump addressed them, most people listened to what he had to say, and they either peacefully walked over to the Capitol or they peacefully walked home. But a very small minority attacked the police, broke into the Capitol, vandalized the Capitol, and some people died in the process. And it won't work if the Capitol is invaded like that. It just doesn't work in a constitutional republic. So this was the first time, really, that a Trump rally or a Trump group of people had sort of devolved into the tactics or the methods of the left that we saw for over 3 months in all the major cities. And they played right into the hands of the left, which is just waiting for something like this because they apply an asymmetrical standard. And it hurt them. I think it hurt them a great deal. And I think that it's a pretty easy standard to distinguish from listening to the president, who has a perfect right, if he chooses to question the election. People have a right to cheer him on if that's what he wants to do. And then when it's over, people go home. But you can't go into the Capitol against the law and break that protocol and attack police officers, as some did. It was a very small percentage, but some did.
And for those who did, there have been a number of narratives. Everyone uses it to craft their own, you know, what we need to do as a result. And I know that they vary, but what do you think the prevailing mentality of those individuals was? Why did they do that? Did they plan it in advance? Did it just happen? Was it a mob? What happened?
I think it's going to take a couple of months to find out, because there's all sort. It's sort of, you know, it's sort of like the Trayvon Martin death and trial and all that. We didn't really find out. We had our suspicions, but we didn't find out till all the evidence was cleared. I'm sure there were some people who had a pre-planned idea. I don't know if these rumors, they had ties, the type. I don't know what that's about. I know there was probably some provocateurs from the left, but I don't think we know yet. All we know is that some people were told not to go in there. They overpowered the police, and they wrecked things, and they used violence, and somebody got killed. A police officer shot a woman going through the window, and another police officer himself was killed, I guess, by a fire. But we don't even have the exact details of all that yet. But I will say that when people went up in there, they should have realized that they were going to be treated asymmetrically. By that, I mean There was 200, over 200 people in 2017 who looted and burned during the Trump inauguration. All of them had their charges dropped, every single one of them. Not one of these people will have their charges dropped. And that was pretty clear. It seems to me, if you watch the summer violence, that there's two standards of justice. So they had to be especially careful because people were just waiting to find them culpable of something and then to apply a severe standard of justice to them.
You know, President Trump, you were very clear not to blame the president, but of course, many in the media and Democrats and even some Republicans have. I find it very frustrating that, as you noted, there is an asymmetrical application of shame and blame and the law, such that people put themselves in great jeopardy to do something that were they on the left and set off a bomb or occupy Senate chambers, they don't get the same response. I think that over a period of time, that creates this tinderbox of pressure where law-abiding citizens say, enough, don't you think?
Yeah, I do, but I think we're all subject to it. I'm a professor or a senior tenured fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and I can tell you that I have been attacked, I have been ridiculed, I am on constant scrutiny by the left at that university where I work. And I can tell you that dozens of Stanford professors cheered on all of the violence this summer. And they wrote things on Twitter and Facebook that were very provocative. Some of my own colleagues did at the Hoover Institution. But I'm not dumb enough to do what they do. Not because not only do I not agree with those methods of encouraging violence or rooting on looting or expressing, you know, really hardcore extreme views, but I understand that they're going to apply a different standard to me. So what do? I try to speak out. I try to point that standard out. I try to write when I'm attacked. I always reply to accusers, but I don't cross that line because then I nullify any value I have for the conservative movement. And so I get just as frustrated as everybody. I don't like going to my mailbox and getting 10 hate letters or getting phone calls where people say, blank, 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 I'm going to do to you, or getting have to go through emails every day, or have my website, you know, trashed by left-wing nuts. But we all have to do that, it seems. But if I play into their hands and I say something provocative on this radio, just a broadcast, you know what's going to happen. Mm. That's it. And sometimes you don't even have to do that. So I'm not trying to say that I'm appeasing or playing into their hands. I'm just trying to ask myself, what's the most effective way I can help the conservative cause? In the case of Donald Trump, I had written an article, I think it was on November 22nd, and I said, he has a perfect right and he should question in a lawsuit why these state legislatures had their voting laws transformed, changed, probably illegally. But he couldn't get any judge to agree with him. So then he said, we want to have recounts, Georgia, Arizona. But I don't think that was going to work because I don't think the problem was the actual counting. I think it was people who were ineligible, dead or out of state or whatever, duplicates. And there was no way I could see that he was going to be able to do that in time. And then he said he wanted to question the data machines. But from what Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood were saying, it wasn't coherent and systematic. So I welcome that. But at some point, this Georgia race was brewing and the media was killing him on it. And the Trump voters were being told not to turn out in Georgia. And the swing voters were saying that Trump was just and he needed to get down there to save us from socialism. And I think at some point around early December, when the electors were going to vote on December 11th, had he just said, okay, I've exhausted every means, I concede, but you know what? We're going to go down with righteous anger and win Georgia, and then we're going to campaign like you wouldn't believe in the midterms. We're going to take the midterms in 2 years, and then like Andrew Jackson, I'm going to storm back with an aggrieved, righteously aggrieved MAGA movement. I think he would have approval right now of 60%. Especially as this agenda, this hard left-wing agenda starts. So I'm not talking about fairness because I understand it's unfair. I'm not saying it's symmetrical. It isn't. I'm just trying to think, how do you get even rather than get mad? How do you advance your cause that thousands of people, millions depend on? And I don't think that capital demonstration, the violent one, advanced it at all. I think it hurt it. The other one that was peaceful, I have no problem with, except I just wish that he had have used that time and that energy earlier on 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 occasions in Georgia to win those two races, because we don't have anything in between us and Washington and Puerto Rico as new states, or 15 Supreme Court judges, or the end of the filibuster, or a national voting, federal voting law that will make mandatory mail-in balloting and one-day registration. That's going to be a federal law under the Democrats, and that's going to override all of these state laws. And I don't know how to stop it. I don't know if anybody knows how to stop it now, because they have these majorities and they have the presidency. But I do think there was a way to stop that on January 5th, but we lost that opportunity.
You sound to be saying that some of that blame can rightfully be put on the doorstep of Donald Trump. How does that hurt his legacy? The left will write their own history, but to sort of the Winston Churchill way, to the extent that he doesn't get to write his own, how does that hurt his legacy with the base and with conservatives, that it's 50-50 and now many folks within the Republican Party will say, well, you're the reason the Democrats are doing what they're doing?
Sure. Well, I don't think it's at all fatal. He has, if you look at recent polls, he's gone from maybe 89 or 90% of Republicans to 85. And while the left keeps quoting left-wing polls, if you look at what Rasmussen says and some NBC, his popularity ranges from 48 to 44, about what it was on Election Day. I think that for all the talk of a bipartisan impeachment, they only had 5%, only 10 representatives who wanted to impeach him, and they're all going to be primary. So I think he's got the basis to recover. And Americans may not like a sore loser, but they can't stand a boastful, conceited winner. And in an ironic way, with him deplatformed from Twitter, he's not tweeting now. We're not hearing from him. But who are we hearing from? We're hearing from, you know, Eugene Robinson on the Washington Post that says all of his supporters need to be deprogrammed, or AOC says that we all have to be de-radicalized or de-bathified. We hear Don Lemon saying we're all Nazis, and all of that is in addition to this agenda that's going to be very radical, stopping fracking. Are we going to, in the middle of a COVID epidemic, we're going to open the border and let in thousands of people who won't be tested, and we're going to test them? So there are things in the pipeline that are developing in the natural news cycle that are going to get people enraged, and they're going to see the wages of what they did by electing Joe Biden. And I think in an ironic way, because Donald Trump won't be there for them to scapegoat, and he won't be replying to every grievance on Twitter, it's going to help him. Absolutely, it's going to help him.
Yeah,
and people are
going to
say, you know, we told you so.
Yep, you missed
me now.
You
never Trumpers. You said, yeah, look at it. Look at what you got. You were the ones that gave us this stuff. You say you're anti-abortion. Look at the most radical abortion bill. You did that. You said that you, for conservative judges, that's what you got with Trump. This is what you got with Joe Biden. And so I think the Never Trumpers and the independents had no idea, or if they did, they were severely mistaken about this left-wing Joe Biden movement. It's not a Democratic movement. It's a hardcore socialist progressive movement. And it's going to alienate a lot of people. And if Donald Trump plays his cards right, I think he can recover.
This past March, you released a book called The Case for Trump. What is Trump's legacy now?
Well, it's three. First of all, there's this record, and the record is before COVID, there was this record booming economy. There was a complete redirection in foreign policy. He got tough with China. He redefined the Middle East. He got our NATO partners to cough up. He killed Baghdadi and Soleimani. He went after terrorists. He didn't get us in start any new, none of these optional wars in the Middle East, conservative judges, energy development, all of that was good. I think after the first 6 months, he started to understand that you can't have a lot of these freelancing and point either people who are unvetted or, but more importantly, swamp Romney Republicans that were everywhere. And he had no choice but to, you know, use the army he had, so to speak. But it took him a while to ferret those people out. And he was getting close to understanding that. I think that he underestimated the power of the left because they control the media, the universities, Hollywood, entertainment, professional sports, not just the Democratic Party, but the administrative state. They control the entire culture, publishing, music. So when he starts attacking them, and the people wanted him to attack them because he was tired of McCain and Romney's passivity, he didn't realize that every time he tweeted or got an argument, he was going to have megatons back, and he could spend his entire time arguing. I think it might have been better to be more selective and just, you know, smile and say, okay, that's what you think, and then get together with his team and see how he can get legislation through that would nullify or neuter these attackers. But when he went on the airwaves and he replied to every single critic, I think he just sort of was in a 360-degree firing squad. They were shooting at him all the time.
You have referred to his language and his insults as uncouth authenticity. I think that Trump is potentially to be remembered most as authentic. And that's the thing I hear from listeners a lot, that he's authentic. He's not a swamp creature. Do you think that at the end of the day that will turn out to have been his greatest personality trait?
Yeah, I think that was important. It really was. And I wrote about that and talked about that. I mean, think of all our candidates that change or modulate even their accent. Hillary Clinton, I'm so tired. And Barack Obama, every time he talked to an inner city audience, he changed his patois. And they all do. They all dress up with, you know, caterpillar hats and jeans. Romney looked like a fool. He would wear plaid and jeans with wingtips. And Trump, he did.
No, oh, I know, and I Trump know. And just, the trees were just the right height in Alabama. I remember well.
Yeah. But everywhere Donald Trump went, whether he came out here to rural California and talked to a bunch of farmers, he wore the same tie. He wore the same shoes. He had the same hair. He had the same Queens accent. And he was authentic. And people didn't like it because it could be crude and uncouth, as I said, but it was authentic. And that's more valuable than refined duplicity. Yes. And with Obama and Hillary, they knew they were being had, and they were eloquent, but they were dishonest. And with the Republicans, the argument that the Republicans were giving their constituents was, well, you guys just calm down, because actually in temperament and culture, we're more like our opponents than we are like you.
That's exactly right.
And you have to entrust us. And people finally said, you know what? I guess I'd rather win ugly than lose nobly. Yeah. And I'm not going to lose nobly anymore. I'm going to win ugly if I have to. And that's what got Donald Trump
elected. It's this sort of raw, unvarnished, real, you know, you get to go into the kitchen and see it made. And you realize, okay, it's an ugly process, but it's real. And I think it's how a lot of us talk. It's how a lot of people communicate. And it's not in political speak. And we had so much of that from the royal families. Professor Victor Davis Hanson, I could take all of your day. I love to hear you talk. Please come back and visit us. You're always welcome on the show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Professor. For years, I've been bragging on the team at Allied Outdoor Solutions in Houston for the beautiful work they do to make your outdoor area, your backyard, look like a resort. Well, their business has just grown and grown organically because they do great work. Your walkways, the area around your pool, your outdoor kitchen, all of that. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. And now, over the years, it's taken 20 years, they're now in Austin, Dallas, and San Antonio. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. 844-846-1010. Call them at 844-846-1010.